Children are a blessing. The Bible never has any doubt about that at all. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are sons born in one's youth, says the psalmist. Happy is the man whose quiver is full of them. And Solomon, whose quiver must have been fuller than most, considering the opportunity provided by that harem we were speaking about last week, completely endorses that verdict in his book of Proverbs. He adds only one proviso. The sons, if they are to be a blessing, must be wise sons. A wise son, he says in chapter 10, verse 1, certainly brings joy to his father. But with candidness typical of Proverbs, Solomon never tries to conceal the exasperation, the disappointment, yes, even the anguish, which children cause their parents when they don't turn out well. But, he says, a foolish son brings grief to his mother. And that realism is echoed several other places too. In 17:21, there's no joy for the father of a fool. 17:25, a foolish son brings bitterness on those who bore him. So according to Solomon, the secret of happiness as far as children goes is to do all you can to make sure yours are wise. Now, how do you go about that? Well, says Solomon, training is the answer. 29 verse 17. Discipline your son, and he will give you peace. He will bring delight to your soul. Now, I guess there are few issues more hotly debated these days than education. And for that reason, if for none other, Proverbs is a book of far greater contemporary relevance than is often realized. For as well as being a handbook on how to be successful in life, as we were thinking about 2 weeks ago, as well as being a guide to a young man on finding a suitable wife, as we were thinking of last week, Proverbs is also, surprisingly enough, a textbook on child-rearing. More than perhaps any other book of the Bible, it has something to say about education. And that's how I propose to summarize the material about children in the book tonight. I have four headings for you if you're taking notes. First of all, educational responsibility. Secondly, educational content. Third, educational method. And fourth, educational realism. Now, I hope those things will help you, at any rate, to get a hold of the balance of teaching that Proverbs presents. This complex subject of education. First of all, educational responsibility. We'll start with that chapter that we read, the first four verses of chapter 4. When I was a boy in my father's house, still tender, and an only child of my mother, he taught me and said, lay hold of my words with all your heart, keep my commands, and you will live. Many people, I think, don't realize that education today is torn between two quite distinct and rival philosophies of education. The first goes right back to the Greeks, and particularly to Plato, and we can call it the state-centered approach to education. On this view, the primary purpose of education is to mold the child into a good citizen, a constructive, cooperative, law-abiding member of society. Education, says this view, is a means by which society protects itself from deviance. You put criminals in prison, you put lunatics in asylums, and you put children in school. It's all the same, really. A great value of the theory, of course, is that it treats education as a means of creating unity and stability in society. Plato's great vision of the Republic, those of you who have ever studied it, is based on the idea of taking children away from their parents and educating them to be what they were meant to be in society. But the danger, of course, is that this leads all too easily to a vicious suppression of individual diversity. Totalitarian regimes universally believe in the state-centered theory of education, and therefore they use school quite unashamedly as instruments of ideological indoctrination. Fascism and communism spring to mind in this regard. And even in democratic societies, Where the state controls education, one still finds subtly societal interests and values being transmitted in the curriculum that's offered. On the other side, there is the other theory. This theory we should probably call the child-centered theory. It begins much more recently, probably with the philosopher Rousseau in the 18th century and his seminal book Émile. This view sees education not as a means of moulding the child, as if it were some amorphous lump of clay to be shaped into some socially useful vessel. It rather sees the child as a living seedling to be nurtured into a unique and individual flower. Society mustn't impose its own stereotype on the personality of the child, says this view. The child must be allowed to develop according to its own inner nature. Now, the advantages of this scheme, of course, is that it does foster creativity and independence of thought. But the danger is that such education also breeds revolutionaries. Revolutions were practically unheard of before the 18th century. It's perhaps not surprising that some historians attribute the French Revolution, at least in part, to Rousseau's writings. Revolutions are now practically everyday occurrences somewhere in the world, and Western education, under the influence of this humanism of Rousseau and later other educationalists who followed him, has been a major factor in generating that intellectual freedom that is the necessary precursor of demands for political freedom. So the struggle rages between state-centred and child-centred education. We don't want to indoctrinate our children, that would be an abuse. On the other hand, we don't want to produce a generation of delinquents and misfits and rebels. We don't want totalitarianism, no, but neither do we want anarchy. What's the answer to this? The Bible's answer is classic, and it seems to me strangely unobserved by so many educationists. In the Bible, education neither centres around the state nor around the child. It centres around the family. It seems to me to be so important, so profound. When I was a boy in my father's house, still tender and only child of my mother, he taught me and said, "Lay hold of my words." Here is a father transmitting to his child what his father, the child's grandfather, had passed on to him. And isn't it an isolated example? The whole tenor of Proverbs assumes that children will be taught the most important lessons of their lives by their parents. Right from the very beginning, in chapter 1, verse 8, "Listen, my son, to your father's instruction." And those words, "my son," keep on recurring again and again. Whether Solomon is speaking to his own children, or whether the philosopher is taking the role of father to those he teaches, doesn't make any difference. The emphasis is there, that this is essentially something family-based, a reflection of paternal, parental care. Now that seems to me immensely important. Because, you see, the family is a kind of mini-society. A child educated in the family circle is certainly going to be confronted by the need to accept authority, to cooperate with others, and generally speaking, to temper its own individual goals by consideration for the welfare and the interests of others. And I'm sure that it's for that reason that anarchists and extreme existentialists like R.D. Lang see the family as a threat to their idolization of individual freedom. It certainly is that. On the other hand, you see, by taking the prerogative of education out of the hands of the state and placing it in the home, an enormous step towards defending society against mass indoctrination is taken. Because the family's got no ideological axe to grind. It relies for its solidarity on kinship affection, not political dogma. Of course, there can be bad families as well as good families. Parents can abuse their educational mandate. They can neglect their children. They can spoil their children. They can use their children for selfish ends. Certainly, parents are not immune from the danger of trying to impose some stereotype on the child, which is foreign and unnecessary. Perhaps trying to force the child to be a copy of themselves. That's a common mistake of parents, isn't it? To use their children, perhaps, to achieve goals which they feel they've failed in. father who always wanted to be good at athletics will push his son to be an athlete. The mother who always wanted to be good at music will push her daughter to play the piano. So the child is subject to psychological pressures that may well not be helpful to it. Oh, we recognize that families can make mistakes, that parents aren't perfect. Nevertheless, it seems that Proverbs feels that the family has got a unique opportunity to socialize the child without subjecting him or her to that vicious psychological manipulation we have learned to fear in the 20th century, which we associate with fascist youth movements and communist schools. Family-based education preserves diversity without sacrificing stability in society. Again and again, Proverbs insists that if parents do this task and children respond to it, the whole of society will be blessed and made prosperous. And that includes the child itself. The child itself will find its life fulfilled and satisfied when this sort of system, this family-based educational system, works. It is the key to creating a responsible independence of thought. Seems to me that's an important initial observation for us to make, then, generally, about the approach of Proverbs to education. Christians need to be aware of that attitude that wants to pass the buck, as far as child's education goes, onto the school, from the home into the establishment, from the parents onto the state. We need to stand against those teachers and educationalists who want to actively encourage parents to abdicate their educational responsibility. For such ambitions often have sinister and politicized motivations. The Bible generally, and Proverbs in particular, is careful to emphasize that education is a parent's job. It is a parent's job to see it is done. No more than that, is a parent's function. To actually get down and personally be involved in the process. That's something our 20th century needs to relearn. That's the first thing, then, educational responsibility. Proverbs sees it invested in the parents. But let's move on to educational content, because I guess the response of many a 20th century parent to the idea that he should educate his own children, at least in some major respect, is one of helplessness. What should I teach them? Well, Proverbs' intention is not to leave us without direction in that matter. Large sections of this book are actually models of parental advice. Lessons drafted either by Solomon himself or somebody else for the purpose of teaching his child. We've already read from one of them. It begins in chapter 1, verse 8, "Listen, my son, to your father's instruction." And it goes on addressing my son in this second person, you, form, right through to the end of chapter 7. That whole passage from chapter 1 through to chapter 7 is a piece of parental guidance, a model of parental education. There's another shorter, similar section in chapter 23, verse 15, running through to 24, verse 22. And there's an even shorter section, recorded as the advice of King Lemuel's mother, which you find in chapter 31, the first 9 verses. Putting all those sections together, because they have quite a lot of material in common, I think we can quite easily identify some of the major areas of educational content which Proverbs feel are important for parents to communicate to their children. And the thing which strikes me about them is that they are not at all like the conventional 20th century curriculum of a school. The things which Proverbs is concerned about in its educational program are moral qualities of life, far more than reading, writing, and arithmetic. Let's look at some of them. Well, for a start, at the beginning of chapter 1, in verse 10 and following of chapter 1, the parent is encouraging his child to avoid bad company, and particularly in this case, the gang. My son, verse 10, if sinners entice you, do not give in to them. If they say, come along with us, let's lie and wait for someone's blood, let's waylay some harmless soul. Verse 15, my son, do not go along with them. Do not set foot on their paths, for their feet rush into sin. The gang, you see, the teenage peer group, if you like, was a worry to parents in the days of Proverbs, just as much as it is to us today. And a parent had a responsibility to warn the child that gangs are sometimes bent on violence and do not do good. Don't give in to them when they try to solicit a new member, no matter how strong that peer group pressure is to come and join the crowd. Resist it, he says. Don't give in to them. Don't go along with them. In chapter 5, he's on about bad company again. Verses 1 to 20, warning about the dangers of the bad woman this time. The adulteress. If you were here last week, you remember we had a little to say about her. Verse 8, keep to a path far from her. Don't go near the door of her house, lest you give your best strength to others and your years to one who is cruel. Several places in this chapter, the virtues of chastity, the ruin of sexual adventurism, is talked about. Sex education, this is something, according to Proverbs, which has to be done in the home. Not with the kind of clinical biological approach of the school laboratory. It's something that can only be done safely between father and son. Another piece of bad company that the father warns his child of several times in these sections is drunkenness. Chapter 23, for instance, verse 19. Do not join those who drink too much wine or gorge themselves on meat, for drunkards and gluttons become poor and drowsiness clothes them in rags. Self-indulgence is a recipe for bankruptcy, says the father. What's more, it makes you a pathetic wreck of a man. Look at verse 29. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaints? Who has needless bruises? Who has bloodshot eyes? Those who linger over wine, who go to sample bowls of mixed wine, do not gaze at wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a snake and poisons like a viper. Your eyes will see strange sights. Your mind imagine confusing things. You will be one like one sleeping on the high seas, lying on top of the rigging. They hurt me, you will say, but I'm not hurt. They beat me, but I don't feel it. When will I wake up so I can find another drink? Amusing, and yet so real, isn't it? The misery of the intoxicated man. Hallucinations, fantasy, euphoria, addiction. And perhaps that sleeping on the high seas entails a bit of nausea, too. It would be wrong to think that all these warnings about bad company and so on reflects a wholly negative approach to education, though. That isn't so at all. Just to give you one example, in chapter 24, verse 13, the father encourages his son in the enjoyment of legitimate pleasure. Eat honey, my son, for it's good. Honey from the comb is sweet to your taste. There are plenty of things to enjoy in life, in other words, which are good and wholesome, without you having to go for those things which are destructive. This isn't a spoil sport mentality. No spirit of asceticism invades Proverbs. Merely one of moderation. There are some things that need to be avoided. And not just people, attitudes too. For instance, in chapter 24, verses 19 to 20, he warns about envying the wicked. This is a dangerous thing to do, says the father to his son, because the wicked's prosperity is very short-term. In chapter 24, verse 17, he warns about not gloating when your enemy fails, because your malicious delight may be more culpable in God's sight than your enemy's guilt. There are strengths to cultivate, too, in this handbook of parental education. Chapter 24, verse 10. The ability to stand strain, to withstand stress. If you falter in times of trouble, your strength is small. And in 24, verse 11 to 12, a spirit of willingness to take initiative when people are in trouble. Rescue those who are being led away to death. Hold back those staggering towards slaughter. If you say we knew nothing about this, doesn't he who weighs the heart perceive it? In other words, don't give way to that sort of sorry I didn't know attitude by which so many people evade responsibility for the lives of others. Responsible citizenship, too. This is something else the father tries to teach his children. In verse 21, fear the Lord and the king, my son, and don't join with the rebellious, for those two will suddenly send destruction upon them, and who knows what calamities they will bring. See, it's by learning to respect our parents and to accept their instruction that we learn to respect authority generally. Conversely, where disobedience to parents becomes normative in society, so does revolution and anarchy. There are lots of other values too. Neighbourliness in chapter 3, verse 27. Honesty in 3, verse 28. Integrity in 3, verse 29. Lots and lots of moral characteristics that you can root out for yourselves in these long sections. But you see, the point about them all is that they differ quite distinctly from the sort of normal school timetable. Geography and chemistry and all those sort of things don't figure here. Even primary schools of skills of reading and writing, they're not represented. It doesn't mean that those things aren't valuable. But surely it does mean that we ought to very seriously consider if our educational priorities aren't askew today. Because it's not at all uncommon, is it, for parents to be much more concerned about whether little Jimmy will get his O-levels than whether he's a thief or not. According to Solomon, no matter how many exams you pass, if education doesn't communicate these fundamental qualities of character and moral judgment, which, remember, he embraces by that overall term of wisdom, then your education has failed. And that surely is why, according to Solomon, education must have a religious component. You see, in the very center of this section of instruction for the son, we read in chapter 3, verse 5, these words. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. We often quote these words. What we forget is that these are the words of a father to his child. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and shun evil. This will bring health to your body and nourishment to your bones. Honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing, and your vats will brim over with new wine. According to Solomon, a child ought to be taught reliance on God, humility before God's commands. He ought to be taught to tithe his money, in the knowledge that these are not crippling and burdensome duties or old-fashioned, irrelevant traditions, but rather that they are pathway to fulfillment and joy in life. He will make your path straight. He will bring health to your body. Your barns will be overflowing. Solomon never hesitates, as so many 20th century educationalists feel they must, about religious education. Because, you see, he's not concerned with teaching chemistry and geography and all those things. It may be feasible to teach such secular subjects, so-called, from a secular viewpoint, though even that is open to serious question. What is quite certain is that there is no way moral values and qualities of character can be taught successfully without some kind of religious foundation. Without the knowledge of someone who will reward us from heaven for our honesty and our integrity and our neighbourliness, and that therefore makes it all worthwhile. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Our education can't communicate wisdom, therefore, unless the fear of the Lord is taught. Educational content, then, quite different from the sort of educational content that we generally think of these days. But I guess the most controversial aspect of Proverbs' theory of education, if you want to call it that, is its methodology. Because, you see, Proverbs believes very strongly in disciplinarian education, reinforced where necessary by corporal punishment. Look at chapter 29, verse 15. The rod of correction imparts wisdom. Or chapter 23, verse 13. Do not withhold discipline for a child. If you punish him with the rod, he will not die. Punish him with the rod and save his soul from death. Now, all this most certainly flies in the face of modern educational method. For two reasons. First of all, as we've already said, modern education insists that a child should not be squeezed into any preset mold, but simply allowed to develop. The idea of directive instruction, of telling the child where it's got to go, rather than leaving the child to experiment and discover for itself, is quite foreign to our modern educationalists. And secondly, because the idea of physical violence being used on a child is widely regarded as degrading. In fact, in Sweden, they've even gone so far, I understand, as to make it illegal for a parent to smack its own child. How does the book of Proverbs seek to defend this methodology. And I think this is a very important aspect of the teaching of Proverbs. It does so, I think, on three grounds. The first ground on which it defends this kind of disciplinarian approach is on the ground of original sin. Chapter 22, verse 15. Folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline will drive it far from him. Now you see, what so many of these educationalists of today say is you shouldn't beat a child. Instead, you should talk to it rationally. But you see, what they forget is that a child is not rational. Sin is not rational. Sin is the height of folly, and that folly is impregnated into every human life from birth. There is folly bound up in the heart of a child. Humanists treat children basically as good. They suggest that it is the environment that has perverted its character. Not so. Children have hearts of malice. And it's one of the tasks of an educational environment to inhibit that malice by suitable behavioural conditioning. Now, if you know the story of the poet Coleridge, who was a Christian, and he was once engaged in a vehement argument with a humanist about the virtues of educating children in this serious way about moral and religious issues. "I'm determined," said the humanist, "to see that my children are not given any direction in these matters. When they come to years of maturity, they will then be free to choose for themselves." A little later, Coleridge asked his visitor if he'd like to see his garden. And the visitor agreed, so Coleridge took him out and showed him a mass of overgrown vegetation adjacent to his property. "This isn't a garden, it's a weed patch," said the visitor. "Oh," replied Coleridge, "that's only because the garden hasn't yet reached its age of discretion. The weeds truly have taken opportunity to grow, but I thought it unfair to prejudice the soil in favour of roses or cabbages. I'm sure it will make that choice spontaneously as soon as it grows up." Well, there's a lot in that little piece of sarcasm. Original sin. If an educationist doesn't take it seriously, he's doomed from the start. Proverbs does. The second ground on which Proverbs defends its the seriousness with which it takes this disciplinarian approach is the grounds of the malleability of a child's personality. Chapter 22, verse 6. "Train a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not turn from it." Now, you see, many educationists treat this malleability as a kind of holy thing, which we mustn't touch. But not Proverbs. Proverbs sees that malleability as imposing a responsibility to discipline and to mould. A child's formative years are an opportunity you can't afford to miss, because that child's personality is going to be moulded for good or ill in an almost irreversible way at that time. People talk about personality as if it were some kind of seed given at birth, which if you just watched and acted as a spectator on it, it would grow up into something useful, but it doesn't. A child which is subjected to no environmental influence, no social contact, it becomes a cabbage, not a personality. Social influences are necessary for us to mature into adult personalities. And the Lord has provided education, the home, as the means of doing that. Permissive education isn't the removal of influence on a child. It's merely the substitution of a different kind of influence, producing therefore a different kind of personality, often a rebellious one. One of the things I find most instructive is the care with which God chose the home environment of the Lord Jesus Christ. He denied him many things when he came to earth. He did not deny himself a good family. For God, you see, knows how important family is to our personalities. So to refuse to discipline a child, to train a child, far from being commendable, is the height of irresponsibility and neglect. Why, says Solomon in 19, verse 18, "Discipline your son, for in that there's hope. Otherwise, you're going to be a willing accomplice in his death." 29:15, "A child left to itself disgraces its mother." That's what happens if you leave a child to itself. You don't get some perfect little innocent, untampered angel growing up. You get something that will disgrace its mother. To be lenient in childhood is to risk much worse in later years, he says. 23:14, punish him with a rod and save his soul from death. That's the second grounds then on which Proverbs defends this firm hand it takes. The malleability of a child's personality demands that we take that responsibility most seriously. But the third and perhaps the most persuasive argument of all the Proverbs would issue to us, I think, in defense of its stronger argument for discipline, is a divine model of parenthood. Look at chapter 3, verse 11 and 12. My son, it says, do not despise the Lord's discipline, and do not resent his rebuke, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, just as a father, the son he delights in. See, when a parent disciplines his child, he's reflecting the image of God in society. Just as a father, the son he delights in. This discipline which Proverbs advocates is not some cruel authoritarianism. It's a reflection of the way God deals with us. God deals with us consistently when he disciplines us. He doesn't blow hot and cold. He sets limits and he keeps to them. He doesn't, like Pavlov did to his dogs, you remember, say one thing one day and then another the next and generate a breakdown in them. No, he's consistent. Therefore, so should parents be. God disciplines with moderation. He never presents himself to us as a picture of unrelenting strictness. For every indication of his wrath, he also presents to us an indication of his love. You know, Freud says that our view of God is very much conditioned by the view of our father that we have. Well, whether he's right on that or not, it's certainly true to say that if a father presents an image of weakness to a child, if a father presents to a child a picture of permissiveness, of complete lack of discipline, as do as you want to, that child is going to find it very difficult to understand the wrath of God when it comes to the gospel. And if it can't understand the wrath of God, neither will it understand the salvation the Lord Jesus Christ died to purchase. One of the reasons our evangelism is so pathetically emaciated these days, why we find it so hard to preach judgment, why therefore men understand grace so little, is because our families have lost that discipline. Fatherhood has a completely wrong image in our minds. Therefore, we cannot understand God's fatherhood aright. God disciplines with love. That's the thing which Solomon emphasizes most here. The Lord disciplines those he loves. It's not a punitive measure. It's not naked retribution. It has the goal of reform. The father wants the child to do better in future. This is why school finds corporal punishment so difficult. Because any physical punishment is likely to be despised and misunderstood when it's performed by strangers. Physical punishment of this kind only has meaning when it's set in the context of home relationships, loving relationships. That's the only place where it's safe to do it. So Solomon can say, you see, he who spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is careful to discipline. This is how God treats us. This is how a good father treats his children. And Solomon is convinced that in the long run, a person treated firmly in that way will be grateful for it. In 28:23, he says that a man who rebukes another man in the end gains more respect than one who flatters him. And if that's true of man-to-man relationships, it must certainly be true of father-son. Chapter 5, verse 12, we are given a picture there of a man who realizes late in life that he has ignored his teacher's discipline, his father's advice, and he rues his stupidity. What a fool I've been, he says. At the end of your life, you groan, how I hated discipline, How my heart spurned correction. In the long run, a child treated firmly is grateful for it, says Solomon. Yet having said all this about method, it would be completely wrong to give you the idea that Proverbs believes that its educational program is infallible. That, you know, if you get the content right and you get the method right and you teach your children this way, like Proverbs says, you are immune from any problems as far as your kids go. No, Proverbs doesn't say that. Solomon is very realistic. Utterly realistic about education. More realistic than many of our contemporary educationalists who seem to think that education is the big answer. If only we got our education right, we wouldn't have any more problems in society. No, not that, says Solomon. For you see, education can be ignored. Ultimately, a parent can only advise and persuade. He can't force. Even when he uses the rod of discipline, there's no way he can compel obedience. And that comes out in several places, in very touching ways. In these appeals, for instance, of the father to his son, like the one in chapter 27, verse 11. Be wise, my son. He says. Notice that appeal? In the imperative. Be wise, my son, and bring joy to my heart. Then I can answer anyone who treats me with contempt. There's a little twisting of the emotional screws there. A man who's got a son to be proud of can stand humiliation in many other areas of life, he says. Be wise, my son. Be the sort of boy I'll be proud of, says his father. And there's another touching remark in chapter 23, verse 15. My son, if your heart is wise, then my heart will be glad. My inmost being will rejoice when your lips speak what's right. That phrase, inmost being, there's literally the kidneys, which is where the Jews located the deepest emotional center of our lives. So he's really saying, you know, a good son really satisfies the old man deep down. But even appeals as emotional as these, and discipline reinforced with the rod, can't guarantee the response that the father longs for. It has to be conditional. If your heart is wise, my heart will be glad. It has to be an if. For you see, Solomon knows that there are those sons who reject their father's teaching. 30 verse 11. There are those who curse their fathers and do not bless their mothers. Those who are pure in their own eyes and yet not cleansed of their filth. Whose eyes are ever so haughty, whose glances are so disdainful, whose teeth are swords and whose jaws are set with knives to devour the poor from the earth, the needy from among mankind. There are people like that, and they come from families. Sometimes it doesn't work out as we would like it to be. 13 verse 1, he says, sometimes a son turns out to be a mocker who won't listen to rebuke. 10 verse 5, sometimes he turns out to be a lazy idler. 1 verse 10, sometimes he gives in to the enticement of the gang, or is captivated by the adulteress, or becomes the companion of gluttons. 29 verse 3, sometimes he squanders his inheritance on prostitutes. 28 verse 24, sometimes he runs off with his parents' money. 19:26, sometimes he even drives his widowed mother out of the house. These things happen, says Solomon. Education is no infallible preventative, you see. For in spite of its youth, in spite of the malleability of his character, a child is still a responsible agent. Look at chapter 20, verse 11. Interesting and important verse stating this very principle. Even a child is known by his actions, by whether his conduct is pure and right. Parents have a responsibility to educate their children, but they do not bear the responsibility for everything their child ever does. The child is responsible for himself. He has to be treated responsibly throughout his life. And whilst it may be true that a parent who neglects to discipline a child has only got himself to blame for the later misery his children may cause him, The fact is, even the best parents sometimes have rebellious children. Lord Rochester said that before he got married, he had 6 theories about bringing up children. Now he has 6 children and no theories. Education is no recipe for utopia. How do we know? Why, because God is the best parent of all. No one educates his children with greater care than God does. Yet because there is folly bound up in the hearts of even his children, sometimes even they turn out to be prodigals. Okay. Let's pray together.